Welcome back to Books, Films, Tilly. Today we'll be discussing season one of the book to television series adaptation of Lockwood and Co., written by Jonathan Stroud. The first book of the Lockwood and Co. series was published in 2013, whilst the television series came out in January of 2023. Okay, I know it's been a really long time. I picked this show for the reason I'm about to explain. But I was also worried that I would not do it justice. So I ended up taking a lot more time like preparing it and working on it. And also because it's the second television series I've done on this show, I'm still trying to figure out how to do those. And I wasn't super happy with what I did with Shadow and Bone, which will be coming out in the next week. So I'm late. I hope everyone's doing well. I know a lot of you have now finished your exams or were just finishing up your exams when the last episode came out, which is wonderful, and I'm so happy for all of you. For those of you who still got exams, I wish you so much good luck. And you should probably not be listening to this if you are. Is there anything new going on with me before I get started? I got new shampoo. I feel like that's the thing I've been the most happy about in these last few weeks, which sounds so silly, but it's honestly just like, it's one of those things that you like hold off on. So you're like, oh, I want to finish my other shampoo. But my shampoo that I was using was completely wrecking my hair. And now I've got a new shampoo and my hair feels really nice and happy. And I don't usually wear my hair in its natural form at all. Like no one ever sees my hair unless it's straightened. So in like a weird way, I'm really happy about it. Otherwise, I've been reading lots and I've been enjoying the sun and I've started running again. I'd forgotten how embarrassing it is to run. I much prefer cycling, but it's also sparked my desire to do other sports as well. So yeah, I think it's been a good couple of weeks and I'm not late on this because of like a bad reason. It's for a good reason. Also, my laptop sounds like it's about to explode, so I'm so sorry the background noise is that, and also the people above us, they've just come back. I don't know, they haven't been here the whole time in the like apartment building, and they keep moving furniture really, really late at night, so I didn't realise what it was a couple of nights ago when it first started, and I genuinely thought there was a rat in my room. I was so freaked out. So yeah, so I apologize for the background noise. I can't really do anything about it, but I don't think it's that much of a problem. Okay, so let's get rolling. I'm really excited about this. I'm always excited, actually. I'm always excited, but I am really excited about talking about this one. I understand the cancelling of television shows. You know, among other things, Leigh Bardugo, the author of the Shadow and Bone trilogy, recently mentioned in an interview how fantasy series specifically are very expensive to produce, and Lockwood & Co. is a fantasy series. However, as I'm sure many of you can deduce, and also I've said this before, book to series adaptations are fantastic because they usually come with a ready-made fan base prepared to promote the series all by itself. In this case, I watched the series to begin with just because there was such a push from the community on social media at the time of its release. I had no intention of putting it in the podcast. I didn't even realize that it was a book to television series adaptation. I was just like, this looks so cool. And I've seen loads of little videos of it. I've seen loads of people talking about it. I want to go watch it. So it's very organic promotion. And all of the biggest film franchises targeted towards younger generations have been born from books. And we know how successful book to television series adaptations can be if done correctly. To name only Good Omens, which is a series inspired by the book by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett, as well as, you know, the entire Game of Thrones franchise. But in the name of yet another show I loved that's being cancelled, today we're doing Lockwood and Co., which was a questionable decision because it was a questionable decision for me to pick Lockwood and Co. because Shadow and Bone season two was rough with two books being adapted in one go, and this is the same jam. But practice practice makes perfect, right? Which is obviously why this is coming out over a week later than it should have done. But I think it will be better. And so the time is worth it. And let's get on with the show. Actually, no, we're not getting on with the show. I have one more thing to say. Before we get started, before we see if I've done better. I watched The Little Mermaid on Thursday in 3D and I loved it. It's a film for people who like musicals, okay? Most Disney princess films are. There are a lot of songs, there are a lot of moments of, you know, just choreographed performances, which are gorgeous and often very complicated, but you have to like that kind of thing. If you don't like that kind of thing, you're probably not gonna like the movie. And I think you will miss the essence of it as well. I almost cried. At the beginning, actually, I'm not sure why, but Hallie's voice is just, it's so beautiful, and it was probably that. There were so many comments on the quality of the CGI, and honestly, I wouldn't worry, like, if that was part of the reason why you wouldn't watch it, it's because you're worried that you wouldn't like the CGI, and then would therefore be too bugged out to watch the film. It's really not that much of an issue, and honestly, the CGI is better than most superhero films we've gotten in the last couple of years, so yeah, I wouldn't worry that much. As a Disney movie, I'd give it a 4 out of 5, maybe even a 4.5 out of 5. It was wonderful and there were no poor actor performances. It gave me that I want to watch this with someone feeling. I watched it with my grandma, who is very much just entertaining me, because I half begged her to go watch it. We were literally just went there to go shopping at the shopping mall. But I remember thinking, as I started feeling weirdly emotional about it, that I would have loved to watch it sitting next to my mama, because she would have understood what I was feeling. And I feel like she would have also enjoyed the music the same way that I was enjoying the music. Anyways, I loved it. I'm a big Disney fan in general, but I really loved this. And I'm happy it was good. Now, Lockwood & Co. I have something devastating to tell you guys. And it's not the fact that it was cancelled, even though that was actually heartbreaking. I was so upset when this came out. But the really heartbreaking thing is, I said I would do something fun this week, maybe something chill. But what I wasn't prepared for was the best book to screen adaptation I've ever seen. I'd already watched and loved the series, you know, but upon cross-examination, this is a bloody masterpiece. It's just, none of the other ones that we've done compare. None of them. The writers, the cast, the casting director, the costume designers, the set crew, the directors, the musicians working on the soundtrack, they went flat out. It was incredible. As in, I already liked the series, but once I'd read the book and then looked back on the series, it's genuinely so impressive. They fixed plot holes, they enriched characters, they heightened tension and emotions and made things make more sense where there were weaknesses. I mean, it was incredible. They altered pacing issues as well to make the pacing better. It's so impressive what they did with the source material. And this show got cancelled by Netflix. And okay, I know we've done a lot of Netflix here, mainly because I don't have the Amazon Prime password. And my access to a cinema has been like heavily affected by the fact I'm in a seaside village in Portugal rather than in London or a big town. But This is genuinely the adaptation that Netflix should be the most proud of, and instead it's been cancelled. I don't understand. I just don't, okay? All of the other big cancellations that have happened of shows that I really like, I've been like, okay, I understand. I enjoyed this, but I understand why it was cancelled. But this, nah. No way, I have no clue. As a book to screen adaptation, this is like a 10 out of 10. there's barely any way this could have been done better. So it's just brilliant. It's actually a masterclass. It's so impressive. But yeah, I'll explain why now. First of all though, you know I've got to explain this plot to you. because otherwise, honestly, in this instance, you genuinely would not understand anything if I didn't explain this to you. So bear with me. And also, it will convince you to read the book or watch the series, because it's a really, really cool fantasy concept. So let me explain. This season is actually a combination of the first and second book of the Lockwood & Co. series, with the first book being Lockwood & Co. The Screaming Staircase, and the second book being Lockwood & Co. The Whispering Skull. But they're both kept in chronological order, despite being in the same season. Both books are in Lucy Carlyle's point of view. I'm not sure if they all are, but I think that they are. I assume that they are. This is a 5-book series. She's our main character. The books are set in the context of the problem. There's a ghost epidemic of sorts occurring in Great Britain that began in the 60s in Kent and became officially recognized in the 70s as people began to study and fight it. These ghosts are named visitors. They're considered dangerous because of their ghost touch that can kill almost instantly if there's enough contact between the person and the visitor, or if the area affected or like touched by the ghost is left unattended. There are 3 types of visitors. Type 1s are non-aggressive and unresponsive. Type 2s are considerably more dangerous and will attack. They also have the capacity for more concrete manifestations. They're often attached to our plane of existence because their deaths were very traumatic. Type 3s contain actual consciences and are a much more complete version of the dead person's soul. They're capable of interacting and speaking with specific people, where other visitors are more echoes of the person who's died, and so their perception of the living is limited. Type 3s remain malevolent, and their rarity has put their existence into question. Not everyone can detect the presence of visitors. Only children with what is referred to as talents can, and they lose these talents as they get older. And depending on the strength of their talent, they can perceive more or less of the visitors. There's the talent of sight, listening, and touch. There are nuances to this, but Lucy has all 3 talents, but her strongest talent is listening, which makes her one of the few people ever able to communicate with type 3s. To stop a visitor, you have to find their source, which is basically the thing that their entity is tied to, and you have to either destroy it or contain it with iron or silver. As the problem escalated, agencies emerged with the intention of fighting the ghost problem in return for financial compensation. And in doing so, they would recruit, train, and manage those who have talent into agents. But not all children with talent became agents. If you became an agent, you'd need sight, because it would be very difficult to actually defend yourself from ghosts if you don't have sight. So there are kids who have talent who aren't agents and who do other things instead in society. And Lockwood & Co. is one of those agencies. DPRAC, the Department of Psychic Research and Control, is the official government organization in charge of studying the problem and monitoring it, whilst also regulating and watching over the agencies. Lockwood & Co. is a very small agency. A lot of agencies have many different teams or units with adult supervisors too, with Rotwells and Fitz being the biggest agencies. They're named after the original duo of agents who first started fighting and classifying visitors. Okay, I know that was a long explanation. It's actually largely incomplete, but it's just so this episode doesn't sound like complete nonsense. Again, the world is very, very cool. It's a great concept. Lucy Carlyle is played by Ruby Stokes, and she joins Lockwood & Co. after an incident that left her entire team dead or unconscious. Besides her, she's the only survivor from this incident, and so she left her previous agency. Anthony Lockwood, who's played by Cameron Chapman, is the charismatic founder and leader of the agency. And the final member of the agency and of their little team is George Kareem. And he is played by Ali Haji Hishmati. And he was at the agency for a whole year before Lucy arrived and is kind of their designated researcher, although he does join them on missions as well. The books that I've read so far from the series are good. I love the fantasy concept a lot. Like, I really, really do. It's for younger readers, apparently. So when I looked it up, it said it was for a 9 to 12 age range for the UK, despite, you know, the scary ghost scenes. I don't know. I think I'd still put it in teams, but the suggested age range of 9 to 12 makes sense when you look at the writing, because like besides some cracking insults, it definitely feels targeted towards a younger age group. Sometimes it was just a little bit, and then there was this, and then we do this, and then this happened, and the pacing was just a bit stunted sometimes, is what I'm saying. And I felt definitely in the second book that the book didn't really know when to focus on a certain moment or event to kind of build atmosphere and tension around it, which obviously makes things a lot easier for younger children, especially as, besides this, the mystery is very much spelled out for them at the end rather than it being something that is spread out and for the reader to kind of deduce themselves. But this was only really an issue in the second book. The first book had me terrified in all the right places. And all things considered, I did really like reading the books. The books are really quite self-aware. The series is really quite self-aware of its content, which I always appreciate. It knows how wrong it is that these young kids are risking their lives for money and for other people with minimal protection. And it kind of backs the argument that poverty removes choices and leaves younger people vulnerable to exploitation from adults because they want to profit off of the children, and or because the younger children can't afford to stand up against the adults and lose their stream of income, or just don't have the means if something bad is happening in relation to their labor, which is often the case when someone is living in poverty, but it's always aggravated when they're children. And obviously this isn't done in an extreme way. This isn't, this whole book isn't dedicated to an anti-child labor agenda, but it's very self-aware, and it does definitely attempt to point out how that situation is wrong. I loved the characters, specifically Lockwood in the book, but I think that's just because he was very competent and controlled and knowledgeable. I loved Lucy. Obviously, we knew her the best because it's in her point of view, but the main reason I liked her is because she was mean. Like, I didn't, some of the stuff she said was just straight out, like, not okay. There were, yeah. So, but at other moments, I really enjoyed her commentary. I don't think I've ever read a character so vicious with her internal remarks, and I'd like to say I read a variety of books, and somehow quite possibly the snarkiest character I've ever read is in a YA book about kids fighting ghosts. But yeah, and you know, to be fair, the dialogue is also quite snarky in between all of them, like genuinely. But her internal monologue is insane. She really dislikes George. And I'm kind of glad that this anti-George agenda was turned into, you know, only a few exchanges where they express animosity towards one another in the series. George is rather hollow in the book. The thing is you don't expect much depth from Lockwood's character because he's the leader, and part of it is that he's calm and controlled and intelligent, but also rather reclusive. That's literally part of the plot line. But George is kind of, he's meant to be the researcher, and instead a lot of the time he either fails to do this correctly or someone else reveals the hard to find clue. So he just feels a little out of place at times, actually. And overall, I thought the dynamics between the characters weren't bad at all. It just felt a tad shallow, which is fine. I will always, always love it when people are just outrageously British or French, but mainly British. And more generally, I love when characters carry the subtle traits of their background and their country. Like, the show is great at this too, but the book just has more room to do it. You know, it's, we express where we come from and our culture from in the way that we speak, in the choice of words and insults and quips. You know, we find it in the Swiss rolls that she's gone to get from the supermarket on a sunny day. Lucy's gone out, and afternoon tea in general, and the biscuits. And I just love it, always. In the same way I appreciated the diversity that was brought to the cast in the television series that wasn't there in the books. The diversity was, you know, not only nice to see, But also it's representative of London, which is an incredibly multicultural city. So I feel like there was a lot of care taken in that decision as well. I think they made the right choice with the actors without considering that diversity, but at the same time I feel like the diversity was necessary as well. Keeping my rating in proportion to the genre and age range, I'd say the first book is definitely hitting 4, maybe 4.5 out of 5 in that 9 to 12 category, not YA. I loved it. I loved the first book. I devoured that book. The second book was more of a 3.5, which is to say I could still see myself rereading it or recommending it to my little brother, for example. I just didn't think it was particularly remarkable, you know? But, oh boy, the series is nuts as an adaptation. As I said before, you know, I said right off the bat, it's incredible. It's been aged up to better suit its audience, which is probably because it's targeting its original readers, who are most likely around my age, maybe a bit younger, maybe a bit older, but my age. So 18, 19, 20, 17, 21, you get it. Honestly, when I'm giving age recommendations, I act like I have a list and I'm aware of what puts books in their categories besides like a subjective point of view. But honestly, most of the time when I say I don't think this belongs in this age category, it's because I'm thinking, would I let my little brother watch this or read this? Honestly, I would let him read the books. I don't think he would like them, but I would let him. And then the television series, there's no way, like that thing's been aged up. I wouldn't want him watching that. It's scary. And I also think, like, visually speaking, a lot of stuff is scarier when you see it rather than when you read it. Actually, I say that, but I genuinely stopped reading book one because it was late and it was dark and I felt scared, so I waited to read it the next day. So, you know, it's all subjective. But yeah, I'd say, like, it's been aged up. It's not for 9 to 12. Interestingly, I think a lot of the aging occurred in the emotional nuances, the enriching of the characters and relationships between these characters. The elements I remember the most are not those pertaining to the scary scenes, but those scenes where a lot of emotion was added, although there was definitely still content added to make things scarier, which would have been hard for younger kids, of course. I think I'll start by saying what I didn't like, but please know that I'm being astronomically picky. Also, I always say that, I'm like, I'm gonna start, but it's always like halfway through the episode, and it just means I'm actually going into detail. So I need to come up with a new phrasing for it. Both of my qualms have very little room for improvement or resolution, and are mainly issues because they're actually there addressing other weaknesses in the books. So these are things that I would change, but it would actually be incredibly hard for me to change anyways, which goes to show just how good this television series is, genuinely. Okay, I know I say this every time, I say this all the time, and the thing is that it's true, and if you find it annoying, then don't point fingers at me, you know? Because it's not me. I'm not the problem. It's the writing. It's always the same thing. Lucy comes off as a little over emotional and over reactionary. And it's done in a slightly odd way where there are a couple of times she starts arguments with Lockwood in the middle of assignments. So not only is she being emotional in a situation that's not appropriate for being emotional or starting an argument and stuff, which makes her irritating, even though I didn't want to be annoyed at her. And I know I was being goaded into being annoyed at her because of the way that her character was being used. And she was starting arguments over things that were not always stuff that was particularly pertaining to the case. You know, I still loved her character fully, and I actually think I preferred her character in the series than I did in the book, just because Ruby Stokes' performance is absolutely fantastic. But I was really worried before I read the book that it would be leaning more heavily into that, and that I would therefore not like Lucy in the book. But it's not really a thing in the book, so it's a thing that the series has created. And in the television series, she ended up spending a lot of time being angry because she was being used, like all of these emotional responses and these emotional reactions were being used to drive plot lines or Lockwood's character development. And of course, women are allowed to be emotional and angry, and she'd gone through a lot. But there's a difference between that and what was portrayed, which was this image of the stereotypical nagging, starting arguments seemingly over nothing or over everything woman. And I just didn't love it. Like, I just didn't like it because I didn't feel like it brought much to her character at all. It didn't bring me closer to her. It was the moments when she was allowed to be vulnerable almost by herself that were better. Lockwood was strengthened as a character because he was allowed to come off as more vulnerable and more like the teenager he is, rather than the charismatic, competent, cool and collected adult in a teenage body he comes off in those first two books of the series, but at the price of Lucy's character. And, you know, there's a similar theme going on with George. He's allowed to be much more human in nature rather than the silly sidekick, which is a caricature. And I loved that. I loved it, by the way. I absolutely loved it for the two of them. And you know, the fact that Lockwood was slightly suicidal and had a panic attack and was very unsure and tired, and at the same time having George feeling isolated and lonely, it was all very realistic and great characterization. I could never get behind the angry, smart, courageous girl having to look after a reckless boy who's charismatic and charming but a little bit out of control. And that was the dynamic at times. It just doesn't do it for me. And it always favors our perception of the male character. The female character always comes out bad. They always look worse. And Book Lucy just has a bit more room to be clever and cunning in the books, rather than just emotional to Lockwood's emotional unavailability. There's this scene where they're encountering basically this criminal, this person who steals the sources, the things that the ghosts are attached to, and then sells them off in the black market, which is completely illegal. And in the series, she's just like really annoyed about having to interact with this character and having to ask for their help. Whereas in the book, okay, she doesn't respect this person. She doesn't like what they do. And she is upset about having to use their help. But she's the one who manages to trick the relic woman into helping them. And it's just, there's just differences. There's differences. And you know, whilst this bugged me out, the series did do a fantastic job at underlining the sheer extent of how superior her talents are compared to her peers. So I don't feel like they did her character a complete disservice at all. I don't think that at all. But it would have been nice to have moments where she displayed a high intensity of emotions which weren't actually Lockwood provoked or Lockwood addressed, which all of the added stuff basically was. And I know it's because they had to basically fabricate a romantic connection between Lucy and Lockwood. I just didn't like it. The one final tiny little thing I felt this series neglected, just a tiny bit, but considering that the fact that these kids being used, exploited, forced to age as quickly as possible, and as a consequence often being killed, or whilst other people profit, is kind of the big moral theme of the book series, I get a free pass to complain about this. Without necessarily having a conclusive opinion, by the way. Look, I feel like I don't talk about this, despite the fact that I do a lot of books which have young children in them. Look, the younger the actors, the easier you'll put across that they're being exploited. And that was probably my only problem with the casting decision. Making Lucy 13 rather than the 8 years she originally was when she joined her first agency and began dealing with visitors professionally did solve the slight plot hole, which was, why had she not gotten her final qualification if she completed all her previous qualifications by the age of 11 and is apparently 15 at the time of the main events of the book? Like, it doesn't make sense that she'd managed to get 3 qualifications in the span of 3 years and then somehow didn't bother to get her last qualification in the 4 years, even though age doesn't seem to be a big factor in the whole thing. But it did lessen, like, that aging up did lessen the potential for outrage at the degree of exploitation occurring. And I do think they actually did a great job at making Ruby Stokes appear, who plays Lucy, appear younger in the flashback scenes, but it still would have benefited from keeping that age. One of the greatest things the series did, besides continuously signalling how old the operatives working with ghosts were, because there aren't just agents, there's also people conducting night watch, so kind of like watching over areas for ghosts whilst people work at night time. And one of the saddest things in the book that Shroud did was state that a Fitz agent, Fitz being the name of the biggest agency in London, whose body had gone missing and was found towards the end of the first book, was only 12 years old when he died. And it was the final line of a chapter, and it had its intended effect, and it had a strong effect as well. I put the book down and I went for a wander around after reading that. And, you know, all this was made worse by the fact that we're told that he was steps away from the location of the ghosts haunting him. He was steps away from living, but he appears to have stumbled and snapped his neck. And it's honestly probably the most heartbreaking detail of book one. But they couldn't include that in the television series because his age wouldn't have made logical sense, because the requirement to join an agency is apparently 13. And I don't feel like the series omitted this critique of the exploitation of children. I simply think that the presence of age-accurate children, even if they'd kept the characters being 15 or older or looking 15 or older, but they'd just been more younger looking children working as agents and working as people in contact with the ghosts and therefore being exploited, I think that would have driven the point better. It would have driven the point that bit more. It's just about how we perceive children, and we will always perceive younger children as less deserving of being exploited and more vulnerable to it. It's just human nature. It will always evoke a certain reaction in us. Now, onto the many, many positives. Ruby and Cameron did a formidable job. No doubt about it, but goodness, I loved Ali's performance. Ali, who played George Karim. George is probably the character with the least depth in the trio in the books, so Ali had the least to work with. The script also worked in his favour, of course, because it's a fantastic script, but his delivery, the way he did such a good job at portraying madness in the second half of the season that represents the second book, he stood his ground in a show more focused on the characters of Lucy and Lockwood and made sure that in the second half of the season, it didn't feel like his parts were an annoying interlude where it's much more split between Lucy and Lockwood on one side and George on the other. He just does a fantastic job, and the improvement of George's character was honestly one of the highlights of the series. Some of the deliveries of his lines were really funny and also very touching as well. And overall, it's very much a cast I wish the best for, because they really deserve more opportunities, and I am so sad for them that this show got cancelled as well. Time for what else is great. The series did a great job at picking what it wanted to focus on in the book and maintain the chronological sequence at the same time as well, which I always appreciate. Then it did an incredible job at enhancing these moments that they picked, that they wanted to focus on, whilst also adding links between chains of events to better explain them when those links were unclear. Honestly, the first episode is the best one to use to explain how this worked. The first episode starts with a combination of Lucy's backstory and an assignment she's on with Lockwood. So we're seeing them already working together with Lucy already being part of the agency, which is how the book begins as well. And obviously the backstory was very emotionally charged to begin with. The reason why she's there is very emotionally charged to begin with. That's basically the criteria for a backstory. The series shows how Lucy was raised in an abusive household and became an agent at the young age of 13. Her mother has forced her into this and is claiming the money her daughter is making for herself, which is what book one shows, with more context about her life before becoming an agent and with Lucy being only 8 at the time she becomes an agent. In the series, they also, by the way, this is all happening in a small village up north. I don't think it said where, but it's not London. It's not London. It's in a small village in the middle of nowhere. In the series, they decide to bring for... Actually, sorry. Just before I say, I'm also almost certain that it's the same village where... In Outlander, where they're staying at before she gets yanked away into the past. When I saw that, I was like, oh, what a random connection. I might not be right, but I'm almost certain. Also, I say that, but then I was also convinced that one of the houses in the series was the Downton Abbey house, and it wasn't. But I was almost certain that it was. In the series, they decide to bring forward this character called Nori and turn her into Lucy's best friend. And the idea of her basically finding a family among her fellow agents is affirmed in the series as it is in the books. And then the series does something very clever, very, very clever, which is they use these jokes that Nori makes to put Lucy at ease when she first joins. These jokes that are at the expense of their supervisor, Agent Jacobs, who's basically the adult leader in charge of their group. That's what a supervisor is. And they use these jokes to actually outline the character of Jacobs very quickly and efficiently as an alcoholic, as someone unprepared to act in the face of ghosts, and as a liability. And it's so subtle, but so important because it explains what happens next in the span of 15 seconds. This incredibly important information in the span of 15 seconds. And this series is incredibly efficient when it comes to providing its viewers with necessary information and does so creatively, you know, and without rupturing the flow of the show. It introduced Lucy and Nori's friendship and at the same time also introduced Agent Jacobs very, very quickly, and it was very well done. Then we're given an explanation as to why Lucy goes to London when the big incident happens where all of her teammates die or are put into comas, and she flees home and she goes to London. And basically this is explained through Nori, who at some point before the incident says to Lucy that the two of them can't stay in their small village forever. They need to go to London, where all the big agencies are based, so they can become famous agents and change their lives. So now we know why Lucy decided to go to London, which wasn't a link that was there in the books. It was a bit more like, oh, and no, she's gone. She's decided to run away to London, which is, it's fairly logical, but is still, it's not explained. And then after the incident in the series, we see ghost-locked Nori. When I say coma, I'm referring to these children being ghost-locked. Essentially, she's in a coma because the influence of a ghost has damaged her brain, because the influence of the ghost was putting psychic pressure on her to immobilize her to the point that her brain is in a permanent state of inactivity, basically. And it's very creepy. The eyes are glazed over white. And so Lucy keeps recording these tapes to send to and to be played for Nori as she's in this coma, so that she can kind of keep Nori up to date on her life. And she starts doing this when she arrives in London and when she joins Lockwood & Co. We see her recording these tapes multiple times throughout the series, and this allows for this continuous reminder throughout the series of what people have lost because of the problem every time she records a new one. And the theory that the problem is man-made is presented right off the bat in both the book and the series and emphasizes the cruelty of the fate of these children, killed, ghost locked, and almost always traumatized. There are people that do believe that the reason why these visitors have started appearing is because something provoked them. Someone made this phenomenon happen. And then in the series, as she's leaving the hospital they took her to after her semi-failed mission that occurred between the segments talking about her past, they added a scene almost right at the beginning of episode 2 where she walks into this room, which almost looks like a hangar filled with rows and rows of ghost locked children in the hospital, and they're all plugged up and they're on these hospital beds, but there's just rows and rows of them in this very impersonal metal room. And it's visually very shocking. It works really well. And this sort of approach of going through and enhancing is implemented consistently throughout the series to great effect. It works so well. And so I don't think you'll be surprised when I tell you that the series is much better than the books at creating tension, and does this by restructuring the placement of clues to transform the storyline into much more of a whodunit, by carefully picking moments from the book that they wish to use and focus on, and constantly using each included scene to enrich the tale. And also through an incredible amount of showing rather than telling, actually in contrast with the books. Yeah, it's really good. I said that the second book had pacing issues. I honestly thought book 2 was considerably longer than book 1, but it's only longer by a little bit. It's not significant. I genuinely thought like book 1 was hitting 350 pages and book 2 was like 500, and they're both, I think there's only 40 pages or something difference between the two of them, but it really dragged. The second book really dragged, and there were definitely elements that were added and drawn attention to from the first book as well, which gave us Ruby Stokes' incredible performance as someone possessed, which was just ridiculously impressive on her part, and also showed us the extent of her power. This scene, it was simply presented differently to give us this performance, and presented differently to put an emphasis on it and on its importance and what it shows about Lucy, which isn't there in the books. There are quite a few scenes which were altered in this manner to be more scary and better suited to the more serious tone of the series. Lucy isn't possessed in the books. She's simply experiencing the emotions of the person. She doesn't almost become the person living that experience. The best alterations are definitely in the second part of the season, where book 2 was unfurling because it had the most pacing issues. Many of these changes created scenes which transformed the series into something visually gorgeous. For the sake of not spoiling anything, I won't tell you which scenes those are, but I'll add pictures of them to the podcast Instagram instead. I just wanted to make that slight detour because despite being literally quite a dark series, there's some outstanding lighting. And many of the sets and locations were also either just ridiculously well reproduced or even improved, which is not something that happens often in a television series. And it was a visual feast. It was fantastic. They should definitely be incredibly proud with some of the visuals they managed to create, because some of them were genuinely stunning. Book 2 was really transformed because, as I said before, they made that effort to choose which moments needed working on, needed focus, so that the series wasn't just a simple sequence of events like it is in the books, and this resolved any pacing issues that there were. Everything in this series is incredibly well carried out. I feel like I say that a lot, but it is. I'm not saying it because I can't think of another compliment. It was a delight to do this one. One of the scenes that was massively changed was this auction scene. Basically, in the second book, the team were trying to recover an incredibly dangerous relic that they're hired to find by DPRAC, which is the official government organization in charge of monitoring the agencies and doing research into the problem. Just a recap. They're hired by DPRAC after this relic was stolen from a site that the Lockwood & Co. team worked on. And they track this relic to a sort of relic gang leader, I don't know. But we'll just refer to him as Winkman, which is his last name. And basically, the team knows that the relic is going up to auction at a secret location in the book. They get in pretty easy peasy up a drain pipe and through a window. And actually, there's a reference to this in the series, which is kind of funny, where they're like, is this our escape plan? And they look at the drain pipe and they're like, this is not gonna work. And it made me laugh watching it the second time. But basically, it's all rather easy. There's only three buyers at the auction, then they get in and get out with little difficulty or drama, besides a bit of fighting, besides finding out some new stuff about some greater enemy. But there's not that much drama. And in the series, they transformed it, this whole sequence of events, into the most emotionally charged passage in the whole series. We had a betrayal, a death, a full-blown auction with cloaks and masks, several sword fights, and one of the most scream-worthy build-ups to a season finale. People neglect that, the episode before the season finale, but no, this was perfect. It was perfect. And it's actually so tragic. I was really clutching my chest whilst watching this, and it was all enhanced by the fact that the series really used their liberty to indulge in a dual POV. Because obviously the book was restrained to one point of view, but the series doesn't have to adhere to that at all. And they used this to indulge in a dual POV and gave us George struggling with the madness that the relic inflicted on him, which is fantastic because it's so tense, even though really those moments of struggle are just a few conversations with Flo Bones, another character from the books who was very well enhanced, and all this happens just on a small boat on a misty part of the Thames. This was fantastic. They also altered quite a few things to make them less childish resolutions or like advancements in the plot. You know, George somehow doesn't die at the end of book two on the grounds that he's short-sighted, which didn't make me laugh. It's just stupid. And only works for 9 to 12 year olds, which the viewers aren't. And there were other things such as Lockwood finding the trail of those who stole the relic, which just made a lot more sense in the series, and I appreciated them being changed. As I said previously, the series does a great job at showing, not telling. They actually isolated George so it would make sense that he felt lonely, and that he was also vulnerable to manipulation in the second half of the series, which is based on the second book. Whereas in the book, he's with Lucy and Lockwood till pretty much the very last moment. And then the series added the visual of George creating spirals to demonstrate that he's been affected by the artifact, rather than have him say something along the lines of "something is wrong, I feel wrong" about a million times in the books, which makes the ending a bit more blatant. Like, the spirals worked a lot better to show that he was under some kind of trance, and there were lots of like quiet moments where he was zoned out doing these spirals and spirals. And the end of episode 7 actually made me screech. It was so well carried out and it made so much sense and I loved it. I've mainly just spoken about book 2, but book 1 was also altered and improved. It was turned into much more of a whodunit than it is in the books. You could have actually resolved the mystery of the first book yourself with the setup of the clues in the series. Does that make sense? As in, like, you could have resolved the mystery going on in the first part of the season because the clues were better spread out and because the clues were more present. Yeah, I simply didn't. Like, I just didn't connect the dots, which was fantastic and made rewatching it all the more entertaining. And the team has a much more logical approach to solving the mystery, which obviously felt more grounded in reality. The more realistic something feels as well, the more scary the fantasy is. And details like this really contributed to it. Book one is centered around trying to find the killer of the visitor attached to a source that Lucy finds during the mission they're involved in as of the beginning of the book. And the source has an engraving. And in the book, they simply try and guess what the engraving stands for, and they do this incorrectly. But in the series, they recognize that the engraving must be why someone wants the source, because it would trace back to whoever paid for it, because it's a very specific engraving, which is a very pragmatic way of resolving a ghost mystery. And there's a logical unfurling of clues with the whole team working to solve it, rather than simply having Lockwood conduct a grand reveal at the end and seeming to resolve everything in one go. And as I said before, the showing rather than telling is very impressive when you consider that usually a book is better at showing rather than telling. And usually a series has to resort to telling because they don't have enough time. They completely fabricated an entire romantic connection as well, whilst also making it credible and slotting it in. I was legitimately dumbfounded when I realised that there was nothing happening between Lockwood and Lucy in the book. Besides the fact that Lucy kind of admired him and Lockwood cared for her as a person. But there wasn't some crazy tension or anything like that. So I was like, that's pretty impressive. And you've got a great use of direct quotations. They were used perfectly and in moderation, which we always appreciate. And also the CGI was pretty good. Usually the CGI is a bit, not a bit, it is pretty bad. In series and also in just Netflix production. But honestly, it looked good. Like, I was honestly quite impressed. I didn't think they were gonna do well. Yeah. Sorry. The music, though. I love the music. The music, the soundtrack was fantastic. Okay? You can sense the care that went into the soundtrack. The Flight, which is a band, did many of the songs for the soundtrack with Christoph Boschinger. The Flight have worked on a lot of video game soundtracks like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, Gotham Knights, as well as Horizon Zero, which means they have this great use of sound effects and they're able to recreate a lot of sounds or just use a lot of sounds very well in the music that they're creating for the soundtrack. In fantasy, you know, we've talked about this before, instrumental music that resembles classical music is often used. Whereas here we have this very atmospheric music with a fantastic amount of bass, as in bass guitar, not bass, as well as drums, which is much better suited for this very grim, low fantasy world. Low fantasy being when there are fantasy elements going on in our world and not in a separate make-believe world, which almost feels dystopian. And it also sets this world kind of behind and apart because it sounds a lot like British rock. And you know, British rock had its heyday in the 80s and 70s. So when we think of it, we don't associate it with particularly modern times. It's an old sound, which echoes this idea that Britain has suffered a slowdown of its development because of the problem. And honestly, like, Joy Division would not have sounded out of place in a soundtrack at all. Also, as I've said before, this show is British, so it feels like what Britain feels like through the language used, the food, the clothing, the settings, and the casting decisions. So, of course, music that originated in Britain and is very emblematic of Britain's overall cultural identity, because most of our biggest artists of all time contributed to British rock, that music is going to sound good in a series set in Britain. Besides the fact that obviously British rock sounds brilliant in anything remotely grim because of the use of bass guitars. I love them and they work so well. And pieces like Finding Annabelle, for example, were just insane. They were just crazy good. And it actually, this piece is such a good example of the overall soundtrack, and there's such an insane variety of instruments and sounds in that piece, so I will link that in the description. I got really enthusiastic over the music, and I was gonna whack a whole entire segment on my controversial choice of who I think should have gotten a lyrical song on this series, which is not something you usually do in series, actually. Like, usually you don't put an original lyrical song into a series. You use songs that are already done, already produced, already out, or you just don't use lyrical songs. But I'm gonna give you my controversial choice anyway, which I tested out, by the way. I'm just gonna leave it here. I could have said they could have asked Arctic Monkeys for an original song, but that's not a controversial take. So I went for controversial, and my controversial take is Joji, with my justification only being the songs Run and will he? Okay, that I feel like that marked the end of any remotely analytical commentary with my outrageous statement. I want to know if you have other opinions. I want to know if you agree with me. It's okay, we can argue about this. Just be prepared for the fact that I fully believe that that is a good idea. Now my genuine, credible opinions are over. The most jarring thing about the whole book for me wasn't any of the fantasy elements. It was trying to figure out how the world was functioning, and I don't even mean in the fantasy sense. They were getting around London so quickly. I had a personal issue with how quickly they were moving around around London. Like, what do you mean you went from Marylebone to Green Park and then to Regent Street? Wouldn't it be just be quicker to go to Oxford Circus? You could walk there. You don't even need to take the tube. And then I had to check whether there was even an Oxford Circus station in 2013 to give, you know, the benefit of the doubt. And there was, because it's one of the oldest tube stations. And so was Marylebone. And they're part of the Bakerloo line, which is one of the oldest lines, which opened in 1906, by the way. So then I was like, ugh, so their destination must be at the bottom of Regent Street, but Regent Street is still a good walk away from Green Park Station. And then I was like, financially speaking, how do all of these big businesses, because all of the big businesses, all of the big manufacturers producing stuff that was helping fight against the problem, like lavender and iron and the rapiers, the iron swords that they're using, yeah, how did they all have their headquarters on Regent Street or just off it? No matter how rich they are, how is that financially viable? Is everything just less expensive because we've just had basically like an economic crash? Do you think they kept the museums? Because I think that some of those ghosts would be justifiably really, really, really pissed off. Also, I genuinely kept wanting to have this conversation with people. I spent 30 minutes at a dinner table trying to pose my theories to my grandma. She's like, I don't have this approach when I read. I don't understand why you're working yourself up over this. No one really entertained me, but I entertained myself, so it was okay. I can still see the tabs at the top of my laptop. I was pulling out the Human Rights Act at 2 a.m. and doing some light reading. Like, I can still see it above from my notes, where I was on the House of Commons Library website reading about the decline in our production of steel, trying to figure out if we would have had enough iron and steel to deal with this situation, because you have to have iron and steel to fight the ghosts and to protect yourself from the ghosts. How did Britain function as a country that was suffering through a gross epidemic as of the 60s? Because that's like a really long time. What were the differences? The Britain we know today was formed in that time. Those 60 years contain an incredibly high density of evolution, politically, economically, and socially. So if someone does a full video essay detailing things like how we would manage having DPRAC, which is basically an additional emergency service and police force, did we manage to still get into the EU? Because we would get into the EU in the 70s. And what would be the legislation surrounding kids dying like that and child labour as of the age of 8? I know they changed it so Lucy actually had to be 13 in the series to begin her training at her first agency. But still, I feel like as a country, we're up for human rights violations in the UN, even with our capacity to veto. I don't know how we get out of that. This is a real issue for me. I need to know this kind of thing. I need to know what people's opinions are on this kind of thing. So I just want to make it clear, I'd actually pay money to watch a detailed essay explaining the repercussions of this hypothetical event. I'd watch it if it was 5 hours long. So if anyone wants to do that, I'll pay good money. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'm sorry it was so late. I know I've already explained, but I am sorry it was so late. That Shadow and Bone episode will be out next week, hopefully, fingers crossed. For those of you who have finished exams, enjoy the weather and your holidays. For those of you finishing exams, good luck. And for those of you who are adults, make sure to sit outside in the evenings whilst the sun is still out and enjoy your weekends. I will see you soon. Bye.